Hi, welcome back to EcoTalk. We are continuing our discussion with two journalists I have a lot of respect for. They both cover the Green Beat, of course. Andy Revkin is the climate reporter for the New York Times. I'm sure you've been reading his dispatches. Maybe you know about his book as well, The North Pole Was Here. As I say, looking more and more prescient all the time as we keep hearing about melting ice shelves and ice sheets and glaciers and all that stuff we thought would be there forever. Also speaking with David Roberts, a staff writer for Grist Magazine, one of our favorite environmental online magazines, and they're talking about the way we cover global warming, and it certainly is very timely, very topical. And when we went to break, David, you were finishing your thought.
Yeah, I was just saying that global warming is a huge communications problem. There's lots of people out there struggling to find the right way to convey the message. I mean, there are the people Andy talked about who frame it as an insurance policy against future risk. There are people who frame it as the house is burning, we got to put it out. There are the religious groups that frame it as a moral challenge, an obligation to God. There are people who frame it as a spiritual challenge, who frame it as, you know, there's lots of different ways you can come at this. What I don't want to see happen is this very characteristically American political dynamic where in order for everyone to compete to be the most reasonable, people start getting branded extremists and alarmists. You know, I mean, what we don't want a circular firing squad here. I would like to see everybody talking about the huge swaths of areas that they agree on, one of which is we need to get started.
And we need to shed more light than heat, pardon the pun, but, you know, I can just see, you know, Hannity, or as I call him, Sean Inanity, going at it, you know, about climate change like it's just a football game. And this issue is obviously so much more serious than, like you say, the usual American way of making this entertainment.
Yeah, and I would like to say that, you know, as you just said, and as others have said, and as I think is clear, even from what Betsy was saying about having seen the movie all those times, that there is a danger in pushing the envelope and being knowingly slightly misleading in terms of the what are clearly the sexiest parts of this question, the parts of it that would most be apt to engage people are, you know, making more Katrinas or the pace of sea level rise. And unfortunately, we're stuck with the reality that the most sort of the sexiest, scariest aspects of this climate problem are also the ones that are imbued with fundamental and really tough uncertainties that aren't going to go away. And that should not be a source of comfort for anyone, but that are a reality. Hurricanes are incredibly complicated, and desert dust from the Sahara can stifle a hurricane in a way that is, irrespective of sea temperature. And more El Niños, which you might get in a warming world, actually shred hurricanes in the Atlantic. So there are these kinds of, rather than sort of glossing over it, which then gives the folks like the one you just mentioned ammunition. I wonder if there's a better way to talk about uncertainty, to not sort of try to downplay it or hide it because you're not trusting that Americans can understand something that's uncertain and still act, but to in a sense, embrace it as a reason to act and just sort of make that argument, which gets around this idea that this is a murky problem. Just says, yes, it is murky, but the downside is so down that it's not the kind of thing you can disengage from anymore.
Well, guys, I want to ask you.
If I had my druthers on framing, I would stop talking about science so much in general.
I agree.
I personally agree that fear and terror and panic are not good long-term motivators, and this is a long-term problem. I would like to see us all turn and start talking about all the many things we can do. I mean, Andy's emphasizing the fact that we can't beat this with current technology. I would take a little bit of issue with that. I don't think that's quite as clear-cut as he makes it out, but at the very least, I know he and I would agree that there are thousands of things that we could be doing now that could have measurable effects.
Okay.
So, to get people mobilized. There are tons of win-win things that are worth doing for a number of reasons.
Okay, let me ask each of you this. On a scale of 1 to 10, I'm curious as to where you think we are on beginning that process. Have we begun? Is it underway? Or, you know, how far along are we or not?
Well, I would say we're on the process of responding as opposed to accepting that something's going on.
Yes, taking action, that's right.
I would give it a 2. And that's a reason I wrote the North Pole Was Here for young people because, we have to sort of get comfortable with the idea that this is at least a two-generation battle and probably a 100-year war, as many scientists have been saying for many years.
And David? Your sense of that?
I I might even cast too as slightly generous. I mean, we're just we're clearing our throats. You know, we're in preamble. We're not even started at all yet. We're just starting to grapple with the notion that. Grapple with the size of the problem.
In fact, on the plane ride home, you know, I had a global warming fever. Not only did I listen to Al Gore for 8 hours, which actually was more than enough, and obviously I think a lot of him and talk a lot about him, it was like, okay, enough. I came up to my hotel room and realized my program was on, streaming live on the Internet, and sure enough, it was about the new global warming movie debuting in Sundance next week, Everything is Cool by Judith Helfand and Daniel Gold. I said, I can't listen anymore to global warming. And I said, let me turn on TV for a change. I never get time to watch anything light at home. Turned on The Simpsons, and guess who was coming out of the TV?
Well, Betsy, I think you make a really good point there, and I just want to reiterate, lots of the things that we could be doing, getting off fossil fuels, changing our land use patterns, changing agricultural practices, lots of these things, there are good reasons to do them that have nothing to do with global warming. They could reduce immediate pollution. They could make us lead happier, healthier lives. There are tons of reasons that I think might be more proximate to people, closer to people, more motivating to people than global warming. So maybe it's best to focus on those middle-term results rather than this constant talk about science, what's going to happen 100 years from now.
And if I could fit in one last thought along those lines, the most powerful points that Gore makes in the film are about values. And I agree with him completely that this whole question, over and over, you can cast it 1,000 different ways. It always ends up boiling down to how much do you value the future? And that is the way it always ends up, because it's like how much are you willing to pay to, you know, limit carbon? How much are you willing to invest in alternate technology research? It's basically how much do you value the future? And that is not a science question. Science has kind of done its job. I don't mean I've finished doing my job. I don't write just about the science of it. But you know, and again, if it's a generational handoff. It's look at your kids and consider this issue.
Well, that's what Bill McDonough says.
You might be more apt to see the scale of it.
It's a question of how, and he's not just talking about global warming, but certainly this is the big one. How do we love our kids, country, and planet?
I know. Well, I hope that, again, it's been a very hot issue, so to speak. You know, I have the unfortunate experience of having written about this since 1985, believe it or not, and 1988, of course, was the great first crescendo of coverage. The Amazon was on fire. We had a record drought and heat wave, and it was a hot issue then, and then it went away when Desert Storm happened, and then all through the 90s, oil prices were low. And, I would love to think that this sort of focus will be sustained. I would hate to see oil prices drop to $40 a barrel and other things change and it to just sort of fade away.
Mm. Well, you made the point that we need leadership, and I think that's exactly right. We need somebody mobilizing and inspiring us to take action. Stop talking about science. Stop arguing with James Inhofe. Tell me that, you know, solar power is convenient. It will, you know, make me personally more financially independent. Tell me about the benefits of doing these things. Get people started. Get people psyched and mobilized. And that, for that, you need spokesmen. And that's why I give Al Gore tons and tons of respect, because, you know, for whatever the minor flaws in his presentation or his science or his tone, he has thrown himself into this, and the effects have been really astonishing.
And I have to tell you, I don't know if this is a scoop or not. He is working on a book all about policy solutions. I think it's going to be more than just what individuals can do, because that's sort of been done. And I have to tell you that the conference ended with Al Gore standing up there talking for about 20 minutes about the experience of how nearly losing his young son, as we saw in the movie, you know, really is what triggered his decision to come out about this issue and really to take it on. And even though we know the story, he really sort of took a while to draw out the story and wondered, I was kind of wondering, why is he doing this? And in the end, he said if he could go back, as he has over the years, and replay when his young son, they were walking out of a game, and his son, you know, his hand slipped from Al Gore's hand, and how if only he had, you know, grabbed on tighter. He said, we're starting to lose our planet, and we're just beginning to lose the grip. And those of you who know what you now know need to go out and be ambassadors and do everything you can. And I have to say, I don't think there was a dry eye in the house. So as I was, I'll admit it, you know, I'm sort of drying my tears. I was thinking, stiff and boring, this guy? I don't think so. I mean, he's not super dynamic, but he's authentic, he is committed, and you almost have to remind yourself that he was vice president for 8 years and wonder what he was doing that back then. I mean, he did a little, but not enough. But also who he is and his political history. He really seems more like an activist. Now, it'll be very interesting to see if he does run, how he'll incorporate all this.
Just goes to show, it's not, like Andy said, it's not science that inspires. It's values. It's human stories. It's human scale emotion and passion that inspire.
And it's we humans who are most to lose.
One thing that I've heard
yeah.
from a number of people who studied this puzzle for a long time is some have noted that the uncertainties and the murkiness of it actually are a great opportunity for a political leader, because when there is that kind of plasticity in an issue, all it takes is someone to push you in one direction or the other. You know, for whatever, however you judge him, Bush did this with Iraq. And, you know, obviously a huge number of
can
people
be done, right?
had a really, thought that was a really bad
so
choice.
So maybe they can use global warming as a wedge issue.
But it shows the power of leadership for whatever, you know,
or lack
better
thereof.
Or worse,
yep.
to take people in a certain direction.
Okay, we're out of time, guys. Thanks for the very lively conversation. We'll have to do it again. Andy Revkin with The New York Times, David Roberts with Grist Magazine. We'll be back with someone who attended that Al Gore event with me. He's a recovering psychiatrist. We'll talk about the impact of seeing too much gore, kind of like witnessing an accident or a crime scene. Can't get the visuals out of my mind. We'll be right back.